welcome to Fitness History. This is another mini-sode, mini-episode. I don't want to keep using the word mini-sode because I think it's a copyright Agent Victoria podcast. But I'm just sure
it's only one of seven, the two of us.
Yeah, exactly. And what's he going to do? So,
we'll find out next week.
And we'll be as soon as this comes out, we get an email immediately saying, you haven't replied to my...
When some expeditionary force starts drawing up outside.
Yeah.
Bombarding. Victorian era expeditionary force. A thousand redcoats and just like a horde of like irregular sort of troops. Local troops that have been sort of brought in. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it could happen. There are enough irregulars around here. myself included. So today's episode, apart from that slightly rambling introduction, is we're going to discuss a couple of dispatch notes that we've done, and also go into a bit more depth, and also I'm going to talk to Dan about his holiday, which before you all switch over to a different channel, this would actually be quite interesting because Dan went to France.
The site of the San Nazaire Raid, which we'll get onto in a bit.
Indeed. Did you want to start or shall I start?
Yours is further back in history, so we'll come forward in history.
Okay, yeah, fine. And also mine is going to be quite short because, as I said before, everyone should know the story because they should be on my email list, which you can join again.
You're welcome on the podcast.
Exactly, yeah. As your footnotesofhistory.com, you can get on the email list and get all the kinds of stuff. And we've got a special Christmas present coming out.
Oh, yes.
Towards
it's
the end
of the
year.
It's a lot nicer than you made it sound. It sounded really sinister.
What, before?
Yeah, Christmas. Maybe the vicious look in your eyes as you said it.
Well,
obviously the listener can't see it. You look like a shark, kind of.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, thinking about his next meal.
it will be a revolutionary present, shall we say, this year.
Good pun. So
unless you're on the Christmas, unless you're on the email list, you won't be seeing that. Without further ado, my dispatch for this episode was going to be on what we called in the email the star-crossed story of the Austrian Germans, which came about because I went on holiday to Vienna. When was it? I think it was last year. Anyway, with Zara, and it was like we had some like minor argument about whether they were speaking Austrian or whether they were speaking German. But obviously they speak German in Austria, because they're sort of like.
Ethnically, ethnically
German, basically. Yeah, they were sort of recognised in 1848 during the year of revolutions and during the Frank. You know, they sent representatives to the Frankfurt Parliament and were mooted as the potential head of the new German Empire, which never happened. But I think it's a four stage. It's a four part story. The first part of the story is in 1848. Well.
Start with 1848.
I've already ruined my story, but yeah. So we start in 1848 with the Frankfurt Parliament considering the Austrian Habsburgs and the Holy Roman Emperors, basically the descendants of, becoming the emperors of Greater Germany. But this was sort of completely pushed off the table, basically, by the fact that the Habsburgs Austrian Germans insisted that the Hungarians, Czechs, Slovaks, that the entire basically Habsburg Empire would be crammed back into Germany, which the Germans wouldn't accept because, first of all, the Germans wouldn't accept because it wouldn't be Germany, and then secondly, the Hungarians and others wouldn't accept because they weren't really that keen on being integrated into a German, majority state. Hmm. So that was off the table. So they went down a different route, and obviously, as we know, the 1848 Frankfurt Parliament failed. But then later on, as it was becoming clear that Prussia would be the leader of Germany, sort of gradually defeating
all opposition.
Almost all opposition, literally, and both militarily and economically. Austria's influence was still pretty strong in the southern German states. They were Catholic, had very similar sort of cultural leanings. So Austria could potentially have sort of been still a leader of a bigger Germany. Mm. Bismarck put paid to that by
demolishing.
Yeah, exactly. by Prussia defeating Austria in 1866, and they were sort of permanently removed, basically. Yeah, the door was slammed in their face again, basically. And then Germany went on to defeat France in 1870, and then the German Empire was unified in 1871, not including Austria. And then the third occasion, when Austria was sort of knocking on the door again, I was like, oh, can I come in, please?
Can't sort of cold.
Penniless. Yeah, literally, as you said, because their entire empire collapsed after World War One. It was sort of penniless and cold, and there was a storm brewing to the east, if I remember correctly, from your...
Storm brewing everywhere.
Yeah, all around them, as sort of Poland and various other countries were kicking off to absorb all their former empire lands. Austria was pretty keen to be sort of... The Austrians were keen to, you know, they were voted on various small plebiscites to join with Germany and become sort of greater Germany again.
That's when you know you're desperate, isn't it? When you're trying to join with like a crippled power after what
That's the thing. I think the Austrians are even more crippled.
Exactly. The loser's a loser.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Don't even talk about the Turkish. But the Americans, although they were like, you know, Wilson was quite keen on self-determination. Not in this case. Basically, thought Germans were all evil, so decided that Austria and Germany could not unite. Basically, and that's the third time that was sort of from the outside pulled apart.
Prized apart.
Exactly, yeah. These two will never get together. Basically, and then the fourth time,
the big one,
when they finally got together in eight. I can't remember what the date was now because it's on my screen.
1938, I think, was it?
1938. Yeah. So the Anschluss with Germany. Under the Nazis, which obviously...
No one wants to remember that now.
Yeah, I mean, it almost... You look back on it and think, now we know why...
Shouldn't have kept that apart for so long.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
It came together in the worst way possible.
Yeah, exactly. It's an absolute disaster. So I think that's probably the reason why nobody really associates Austria with Germany, despite the fact that they are so very similar and historically intertwined.
And it's definitely never happening now.
Yeah, almost certainly. Well, I don't know. I think in some ways the European Union manages to... It's a bit like Northern Ireland and Ireland.
Hmm.
It kind of manages to pacify the nationalist feelings on both sides because they can kind of believe that they're all one, even though they're...
Until about 10 years of an empire, like falls apart.
That's the story of the Austrian Germans essentially, and
as we said, in many ways, Hitler's the embodiment of Anschluss in human form.
Yeah, exactly. And I think he gives it a bad, you know, obviously he gives it a bad name. Sorry,
he gives everything a bad name.
I know, obviously, but like the concept in principle is not necessarily a Nazi idea.
It goes back further. He's just ruined it.
Yeah, I know. I've ruined the joke.
He's just ruined it, not you.
Oh, he's ruined.
Hitler's ruined it.
They ruined it forever.
Yeah.
They ruined the idea. It's like Romeo and Juliet as if they
were Nazis.
Yeah, pretty much. So a romantic story ends in sort of bitter disappointment for almost everybody.
Mm. Lots of people die.
Yeah, and lots of people die. So
people would kill themselves at the end.
Yes. So the Romeo and Juliet comparison carries on. Anyway, with that sort of slightly bungled story out of the way, why are you going to tell us about your trip? Your holiday, rather.
Yeah, basically, yeah. It was really good fun, actually. So what happened was, about a year or so ago, a bit longer actually, one of my friends watched a documentary that Jeremy Clarkson had done, which I know, I was of the same opinion.
Yeah, but it's quite weird, right? Because Jeremy Clarkson now does Who Wants to Be a Millionaire as well.
Yeah, he does, yeah.
More zany.
Yeah. And I'm not sure when he actually did it, but he went to go through a phase of doing World War II documentaries for BBC. And he did this one on something called the San Nazaire Raid, which is called the greatest raid of all by kind of people who enjoy military history, I think, and people who were involved in like the Marines. And it's basically in World War II.
But that's okay because all of our listeners are.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Not in the Marines, but yeah.
If they were, it'd be pretty cool. Yeah. Also, I would wonder how we managed to hit that niche.
Yeah, Well, that's quite the Venn diagram. Yeah, go on, sorry.
In World War II, obviously, Britain was cut off quite quickly into its own island kind of sphere. It's relied on the Atlantic convoys coming across and being resupplied by sea. Obviously, we all know the German U-boats descended to try and stop them. And the biggest kind of fear that Churchill and the rest of the high command had was of these German battleships, or pocket battleships, I think they were called, getting into the Atlantic and like wreaking havoc across them. So this is what the Bismarck tried to do and was sunk and like hunted down and sunk.
Yeah.
And then they had another one called the Tirpitz, which was kind of like it escaped, basically escaped. Tirpitz kind of escaped from German harbors into Norway, into the fjords, and then obviously the Admiralty kind of lost track of it. They had this kind of rising fear that it would get out and like into the into the Atlantic. So they decided to try and stop it, was they had to try and stop any hope of it being repaired on the Atlantic coast. And there's only one place that had a dry dock big enough to actually fit it. This is in a town, French port called Saint-Nazaire. So effectively they came up with this idea of piling a load of marines onto a small flotilla of ships and this ancient kind of World War One era destroyer called the HMS Campbelltown, which had been originally given to Britain by the Americans, was loaded with loads of just like a huge amount of explosives, and they basically sailed them out of Falmouth.
Falmouth.
Okay. There's a small memorial there apparently. To the Great Raid, which we're going to do on a small, another trip. We're going to go to Falmouth to see that, like, the setting off area.
Talk to me about that afterwards, because that could be an interesting collaboration there.
Yeah, well, you can come as well. We were actually saying, because it was my brother, Matt, was on the trip as well. He said, Tim would enjoy a good Battlefield story, and I'm pretty sure Tim would.
Yeah. And we should bring the Footnotes of History team as well.
Exactly, yeah.
When I say team, I mean
the
microphone.
We'll do that next time. But anyway, they sailed out of Falmouth in a small flotilla. They sailed into kind of Saint-Nazaire, which is kind of like an estuary, under German colours. They snuck in under sort of darkness. As they kind of neared their like target, the Germans worked out that obviously they weren't German, and then it's like hit them with everything they had, which was like all these shore batteries firing at once into this flotilla, shells blasting off and everything like that. And then they got the destroyer, like sent it into literally ramming speed, smashed it into the dock, the kind of dry dock wall. The Marines all jumped out of their boats, started machine gunning everything in sight and blowing up all of the sort of the bits that helped the dock work. Obviously they kind of got fought to a standstill by the Germans, who kind of brought more force to bear. And the best bit of the story is that there's 100 Marines kind of left on the dock. They looked back at their ships, had all been basically burned or had to evacuate, and the commander's like, right chaps, we're not getting out that way, we're gonna have to head to Spain, and this is in northern France. So then they all decided they just ran through the old town, so basically fighting through everything they could. Five of them actually got out and got to Spain. The rest were captured. And at this point, the Germans were quite happy because they're like, oh, look, stupid British. All they did manage to ram a ship into the dock and didn't even break through the barrier. So
you're saying they actually failed?
Well, this is it. Okay. This is it. So the Germans sent all these like people to take propaganda, I assume propaganda-esque photos of it. What they didn't really think of was actually the explosives were on timer, and then they just exploded, blew up the entire literal wall of the dock, letting all the water in and stuff. Mm. And so much explosives was in there that it actually sent bits of the Germans across the whole harbour onto the top of what was the U-boat pens that we saw there. So that was kind of the story of it. And so obviously the dock was completely out of action. The turbots never got out of the fjords and was eventually cornered and blown up by the RAF, I think. And it's called the greatest wedge of all because of the extreme heroism that was taken in. So that's why we decided to go.
Sorry, I was going to say, especially the Marines who, if only five of them survived. Sort of slightly amusing attitude of of bravery, in the sense that okay, we're not going to be able to get out. So we're going to have to just plan B, what we can.
That's basically what it was like. Order one was kind of like escape to Spain if you can. Two is just keep like running, going as far as you can. Three is just like fight until you have nothing left effectively. And it literally was basically like that. So I mean, we all kind of watched this. Stephen showed it to me, and I thought, Matt quite enjoyed it, showed it to him. Mm. Then one of our other friends was allegedly meant to have seen it, but turns out they never actually watched it and just came along. I had no idea what was happening. And so it was just a really interesting time because we went to Nantes, which is a kind of like a nice old French town, northern French town, which is like the biggest settlement near Saint-Nazaire. Then we went to a day trip to Saint-Nazaire and walked around, basically around the U-boat pens, which they still have there.
Are there U-boats in them?
There was a French submarine in one of them. So you can actually go onto the submarine and have a look around there. So although it's not an actual U-boat, it's based on the U-boats. And so it's nice.
From World War Two.
From after World War Two. So it's kind of like the next generation of submarines after World War Two. It's based on the U-boat design kind of thing. You walk around and so you can get a sense of where everything was because it's kind of like still laid out the same way. You can't actually get onto the dock, unfortunately, the dry dock they blew up. They've rebuilt it, but you can get very close to it.
Yeah.
And you can get out onto kind of like the bit of a spit of land and look back onto the whole like harbour front to see it.
Yeah.
And interesting, you can walk across the bridge where they were charged across to get out to Spain.
We think
we found a few bullet scars, but we weren't entirely sure. Unconfirmed, not entirely sure. It's still the same bridge. Weirdly enough, we were walking down past the main harbour and there was a Frenchman and he'd been fishing and he fished out a gun, which was like quite kind of fossilized and had all this stuff. We didn't go over and like like, let's go over and talk to him, because he was quite elderly. Not confirmed if our rudimentary French and his potential no English could actually bridge the gap of asking, was this a gun from the raid? And obviously he wouldn't know because he was fished out, but it's quite cool. Like, the first thing we saw was this man holding an old kind of like gun covered in sort of your old sea, like, crustaceans and stuff. It's like, oh, history is literally all around us. And then
I was going to say something really cynical, like, I wonder why that happened right then.
it's literally looking at it, look at these tourists.
I'll give you this for 20 euros.
And there's a nice memorial there to them and stuff, and a couple of plaques, and there's an old gun from the Campbelltown, which is the destroy that blew up. And then we all, as I said to you before, it started off, the whole thing was a little bit in-betweens-esque, because for a start, there's four guys, like the in-betweeners, before Stephen and...
Irina didn't go then, obviously.
Irina didn't go, no, she was lads holiday. I'm pretty sure she was quite glad she didn't go, to be honest.
And then we
me and Matt flew out on the Friday. Stephen and Mikkel had gone the day before and stayed in a boat, because it was an Airbnb thing. We thought, this is the weirdest one we can find. Stephen had been sick the night before we turned up. Then, I think alcohol related.
Okay, so it wasn't because of the boat.
No, it wasn't, because I think the rocking probably didn't help. But then, that was already one kind of in between desk thing. And I was sick the day after we got back, the day we got from Sans Air, because I think I put it down to I had quite a lot of quite rich food, such as mussels and gorgonzola sauce, which we had on the harbour front of Sans Air. And I think it all just overwhelmed me, because I had no fruit or vegetables. I literally just had cheese, wine, various breads related, and chocolate, and this muscle based thing, which I don't know why I ordered, because I never really eat mussels, but I thought,
why not?
Next to the sea.
So, yeah, exactly.
Might as well. They probably just caught them and shipped them in. But yeah, so that was it.
Shipped them in for the tourists. Yeah. For the history tourists.
Yeah, but that was it.
Was it presumably it's not very touristy?
Not really. I mean, I think
it's quite a small place.
It's just like a small port, really. I think it has kind of like remnants of heavy industry there, because they kind of used to make big sort of ocean liners there. And I think they're kind of quite bemused by people turning up to look at this, because obviously, like, imagine the people there, it was quite a terrifying experience having these, like, people just turning up and blowing the hell out of your backyard. It was an interesting point, which I tried to find out, because there's a couple of benches that have been dedicated to the people of Saint-Nazaire by basically the Saint-Nazaire Raid Association. People, I think it's probably like started by the veterans and then carried on by other people in the Marines and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was dedicated to the people of Saint-Nazaire who were killed in the raid, who like rose up at the same time. So I'm not sure whether they just were part of the resistance or just saw the opportunity to pitch in and help.
Even
on the monument, there's obviously all the soldiers and sailors who died.
Yeah.
And then below them, there's a load of French names as well, which are, again, presumably the civilians who joined in to help. So you don't really... Jeremy Carson doesn't cover them in the documentary. I'm not sure whether it's because he's French and he doesn't actually like the French. But they seem like quite interesting. But yeah, that does frustrate me about Jeremy Clarkson, because those documentaries are really good.
Yeah.
And he's really serious in them, and they're actually just properly good documentaries by any stretch of the imagination.
Okay.
But when he does his other persona, it's just so far removed from that.
Yeah.
That's what winds me up about. It's not that his persona winds me up, it's the fact that he has the capacity to be so much better than he is, in that sense.
Well, yeah, I think you know, in some ways he's sort of responding to...
He's playing to the gallery, but I feel like he shouldn't. He should just present those documentaries, because... they're really good documentaries.
So what would you prefer? Would you prefer the history documentary in his Top Gear personality?
No, I prefer history.
Or Top Gear in his history
personality. I prefer him not do Top Gear. Which, I mean, he hasn't got a choice now, because he got fired, obviously.
I prefer him to make
more of the documentaries.
Yeah.
Because I don't think he made that many of them.
No.
But they're just generally very good documentaries. And just like very, you know, they draw you in, they give you the good story.
But did he make them? That's what I'm saying.
I mean, he presented them, and I think they're his passion journalist. Project. And so, I think it's because his... I think his ex-father-in-law was a winner of the VC or something like that, Victoria Cross, and he would...
It's like some kid at work said the other day, it's like, oh yeah, my granddad was in the army. It's like, everyone's granddad was in the
This is where he gets the interest from.
I'm just exaggerating the fact.
And he's a really interesting man, actually, his ex-father-in-law. He would take, like, small British anti-tank weapon, which is like a handheld anti-tank weapon, and then go and hunt down German tanks, literally just go and hunt them and then blow them out. He had to get in really close to actually use this thing, and he just like wander out into the fields around Arnhem at one point, and he just go and hunt down these like panzers and stuff on his own.
That's quite cool.
Insane.
It's almost like the the Lone Ranger.
He's like a Maverick type thing. You see him in the San Jose with the whole we'll fight away to Spain and stuff like that. You see the whole Maverick kind of element to the army and armed force in those days. But yes, I mean, that was a history trip, and hopefully we'll be, me and Tim were saying off air that we should do a couple of on location episodes. So hopefully, you know, put that into action at some point, fly out somewhere and, you know, descend on this unsuspecting sleepy hamlet that Bismarck once, I don't know, shot up.
Yeah. And then, when do we visit his spa town?
Yes, we should visit
his spa town. I don't think Bismarck's going to shoot anything up, as we were discussing earlier. He's never actually in the army.
Never fired a gun in anger.
Yeah. Shot his mouth. Very angry. Yeah. But yeah, okay. So.
Yeah, that was San Zan. I mean, as you said, go on, sorry.
I was going to say, I was going to end the episode.
Yeah, end the episode, yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully, we might do a Falmouth episode as well, as you just said.
Yeah.
As you were threatening to speak to me off air about it.
I think we should. Definitely. And you'll only hear about it, you'll hear about it firsthand from joining the email list. So, footnoteshistory.com. Mm-hmm. On the homepage, you can just sign up. And as I said, look out for that Christmas present.
That's coming up.
Coming towards the end of the year.
Christmas time.
You won't regret it. Yeah, but I think it might be slightly earlier than Christmas.
Okay.
Just to.
It's a pity we didn't do 25 bits of it. We've moved to 12 because they're 12 days of
Christmas.
Yeah. 12 days of footnotes.
I can't remember how many episodes there are. I think we need to do one more, by the way, because it's like a thematic overview, which we never did.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
But it's no big deal. I've also worked on. Anyway, this is kind of like off air stuff. But thanks for listening.